Okay, thank you for the invitation and all of that. So when Brad asked me to give a title, I kind of, without really thinking, I said wave mean flow interaction and global warming. and I thought that was a bit glib. but then thinking about it a bit more, and after being in the British funding system for a little while, when we have to add two pages of pathways to impact for every proposal, it makes these broader impacts of NSF seem nothing at all. But I thought it was kind of a nice title, and it made me think about other titles which people might want to use in future. I was thinking of Jacques Vernest for this. He might want to use this in his next, his next proposal, his next talk. And, why not? I've got one for, I thought Oliver might like this one. But you're free to, anybody's free to use them. We'll come to that in a minute. It's a very good prop. So, of course, in honor of the organizers, I thought, Brad and Steve Tobias might want to use that one. So wave mean flow interaction and global warming, or perhaps a slightly more serious title, would be the response of the large-scale structure of the atmosphere to an increase in greenhouse gases. So this is going to be actually a little bit more of an applied talk than the previous one. That would be great, wouldn't it? Yeah. Sorry. But a note to myself, I guess, when I was thinking about this. Just because a problem is important is not a reason to not study it. I think sometimes we have this attitude that we want to stay clear of anything that's at all relevant to society. The reason, of course, that I think I'm going to talk about the general circulation of the atmosphere. It's actually changes, making a serious point, that it's changes in the general circulation of the atmosphere which do determine the regional changes of climate. So if we're interested in changes in storminess in California or the Rockies or England or whatever, those changes are really going to be determined by the large-scale changes in the atmosphere, by shifts in the jet stream or the expansion of the Hadley cell or whatever. And they're not going to be confined to regional changes. So things like downscaling, which is a popular term these days to do with general circulation models, meaning putting a lot of resolution in one spot, if you have the general circulation wrong, you're just going to get the wrong answer in more detail if you downscale. So coming to global warming, this is what we're talking about, of course. This is the increase, just ignore the last part of the graph, but this is the actual observed increase in temperature over the last 110 years or so. Not quite monotonic, there was a bit of a hiatus in the 1940s. Temperature didn't go up from about 1945 to 1975 or so. There's been another hiatus recently over the last 15 years or so. Temperature has not gone up at all in terms of the globally average surface temperature. Reasons abound. There are probably more theories for the current hiatus than there are people in this room. Presumably, temperature will start increasing again in the future. This is actually the reconstructed temperatures using mainly tree ring data, but also other proxies over the past 1,000 years or so. In fact, this is the well-known hockey stick, and I've never had such an appropriate prop to show this graph. So there we are. It really is. Fairly constant. There's hints of it of a warmer temperature down here in about the year 1000. This is the so-called medieval warm period. Hints of it being somewhat cooler than average here. This is the Little Ice Age. But over the past 150 years, the temperature increase has been unprecedented in its rapidity and its amplitude. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I'm not an expert at all in tree rings, so I'm. The width of this gray line is some measure of the errors in the data. I think you'd have to defer to experts, of which I am not. But it seems to me that the consensus is that it's a fair measure of temperature over the past 1,000 years. Yes. Yeah, but certainly going back to about 1800, the increase is really uncontroversial. So, go on. Well, it's a different time series. This is 800.
No, okay.
To 2000.
That's the rightmost corner of you. Why don't I see a hockey stick up there?
Because if this went down, and I mean it's been going up since about 1900, so this graph starts about here, where it's been going up. So if you just take this where there is a solid curve here, and expand this out, it would look like this.
It starts at 1900, which is halfway between your two last tick marks, there, right?
This is 1900 here,
yeah.
And this is about 1900 here. So this is just going up from 1900. There's no reason why this should look like a hockey stick. I think let's move on, okay? Let's just move on. But I'm not going to talk about temperature increase after this. That's not my goal of this talk. I'm going to ask what changes in the structure of the atmosphere might arise as a consequence of this warming. And so I'm going to argue, in a sense, that changes that involve thermodynamics and radiation seem relatively robust. Changes that involve dynamics, which is sort of the subject of this conference, are less certain and possibly less robust. And by robust, I mean that if you know the parameters and the forcing, you can calculate the response reasonably well. There's no particular sensitive dependence on the parameters. So in a way, there are two practical measures of robustness. One is the consistency of response in a variety of models. So this field of global warming has become characterized by large numbers of modeling centers around the world using the most complex models, some of the most complex software ever developed, running simulations under a variety of scenarios with increased concentrations of carbon dioxide. So those models have been submitted to the IPCC, and you can download the results from the archive. So if all the models give the same result, that will be some measure of robustness, I think, a practical measure of robustness, but would also like to have an underlying physical mechanism which you can explain, which describes those changes. My particular interest in this talk will be twofold: the vertical structure of the atmosphere, namely the height of the tropopause, mainly, and the latitudinal structure of the circulation, namely whether the Hadley cell is getting bigger, whether the westerly winds in the atmosphere are getting are moving or not. Here's the prediction of warming. CMIP5 just means Climate Model Intercomparison Project 5. It's also IPCC models, essentially. These are, each of these thin gray lines shows the increase in temperature over the next 70 years under a particular warming scenario. So there's about 20 different lines here. And the black line is the model average. This particular scenario is a 1% increase in carbon dioxide every year. So after 70 years, carbon dioxide has doubled. So a typical response to a doubling in carbon dioxide, according to these models, is a little bit less than 2 degrees Celsius. So this is pretty consistent. It's a fairly robust response. All the models agree that temperature is increasing. And furthermore, the increase in the temperature, the change, is larger than the intermodel standard deviation. So it's not like the spread in the model results. Here, the spread in the model results is actually smaller than the signal. So there is a decent signal to noise ratio, if you will. I think that comes back to this point. Certainly the models have been tuned, but if in addition we have an argument which we can explain to those people as to why there's going to be warming, which is to some degree model independent, that's sort of another way of making the argument. Yes, no, I agree. Yeah, no, I agree. I think we're agreeing. That's what this means, I think. Yes, Bill. Yeah. Yeah, it is indeed. I think they wouldn't accept that. Some of them wouldn't accept that. People will argue that the increase in carbon dioxide is actually a response to the increase in temperature. That the increase in temperature has caused some change in the weathering, and therefore the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere has gone up. That's a bit of a silly argument. One reason is that we know that, we get it off off topic, but one reason we know is that the actual, most of the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has actually come from fossil fuels burning, and we know that because of the isotopic composition of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has actually come from fossil fuels. But we're all on the same page here. Temperature increases, this is the average increase actually per decade of all of these models, and there's some polar amplification in the northern hemisphere, and this is the warming as a function of latitude and height from all of the various models. Don't worry about the absolute scale, but a couple of things to note are that there's enhanced warming here, so at low latitudes aloft. There's also some warming here. So most of the models produce this. This enhanced warming at higher levels in the tropics, but we can actually understand that. We can give you an argument for that. And the argument is that the lapse rate, which is the vertical change of temperature with height, changes with temperature according to the moist adiabatic lapse rate. which is the lapse rate, which is just marginally stable to convection in the presence of water vapor. If there were no water vapor, it would be the dry adiabatic lapse rate, but it's the most adiabatic lapse rate, and it's given by this expression. And this is actually a function of temperature. And when temperature increases, the most adiabatic lapse rate actually decreases, meaning that at higher temperatures, you get more warming aloft simply because of this well-known and well-understood most adiabatic lapse rate. And I will actually show you. This is what the most adiabatic lapse rate is, minus dT dZ. And I plotted it here as a function of temperature. So at high temperatures, 300 Celsius, it's about 4 degrees per kilometer. At lower temperatures, it's much larger. If temperature increases, the lapse rate decreases, so the temperature falls off less with height, so you get this enhanced warming here. So that's the kind of the argument I mean is a robust argument. It's really independent of the models. But it's very nice that nearly all of the models do reproduce that. Well, so well, you soon know, we certainly get cooling in the stratosphere. The other thing that we will get is this is the tropopause height has increased, and we'll see that there's a robust argument for the tropopause to increase also. So let me tell you what the tropopause is. Well, let me get to that. That's if I ever do. let me get to that later on. That's meant to be the topic of my talk. Thank you, Richard. This is a vertical structure of the atmosphere in an idealization. This is the troposphere, which is about the lowest 10 kilometers of the atmosphere, is the region where temperature falls off fairly uniformly. And then in the lower stratosphere, temperature is uniform, and then it increases with height. These are actually some observations of that. The tropopause is the level at which this stratification changes. So put another way, in the troposphere, the lower atmosphere, it's a region of fast dynamics in which the stratification is set dynamically. In the stratosphere, stratification is set radiatively, primarily. Now, you can calculate, again, fairly robustly, I'm going to argue, that the tropopause height will actually increase with global warming. And again, it's really independent of models. And that's something called the radiative constraint, in a sense. If we imagine that the atmosphere to be a single column, so the temperature is decreasing uniformly to some height, which is the tropopause. Now, and the lapse rate here is fixed. Depending upon the height of the tropopause, you'll actually get different measures of outgoing radiation. And only one of those can be correct, because the incoming radiation has to match the outgoing radiation. The lapse rate could change too, and I'll come to that also in a minute. But the lapse rate probably isn't going to change that much, but it could. But I'll come to that in a minute. Let's do a radiative calculation. Let's pretend for the moment that the atmosphere is a single column, and there's no lateral variation. So then we'll also suppose that the atmosphere is gray. And these are the radiative transfer equations. This is D for downward radiation, U for upward radiation, tau is the transmittivity, B is sigma T to the fourth. These are the radiation transfer equations going back over 100 years, I think. We can rewrite them in this form, which is nice because U minus D is actually the heating. So tau is a function of Z. Tau will be very small in the stratosphere. It's the transmissivity. Let's make an assumption that the stratosphere is in long-wave radiative equilibrium. Okay, we said that dynamics are slow. It's dominated by radiation. And then also, we can then write the solutions of these equations. These three expressions are solutions of this equation in terms of what the OLR is. The OLR is the outgoing long-wave radiation. Now, the outgoing long-wave radiation does not change with global warming because the outgoing long-wave radiation is equal to the incoming solar radiation. So at lowest order, that's not going to change unless something like climateness changes. So this is fixed. OLR is fixed. Now, let's make an additional assumption that the stratosphere is optically thin, which it is. Then the solutions for that are, this is for the radiation transfer equations in the stratosphere, D equals zero. There's no downwards radiation because there's no atmosphere above you. The upwards radiation is equal to the outgoing long wave radiation, which is just 2B, 2 times sigma T to the fourth. And B itself is equal to the outgoing long wave radiation divided by 2. T is the temperature in the stratosphere because, and therefore at the tropopause, because the solution of this equation is that the stratosphere is isothermal. And the stratosphere will be isothermal if there's no source of shortwave heating. So the solution of the equations are that the stratosphere is isothermal and its temperature is fixed by the outgoing long wave radiation. That temperature is equal to the temperature of the tropopause. So that's the lowest point of the stratosphere. So when we have global warming, the outgoing long wave radiation doesn't change, so the temperature of the tropopause stays the same. Okay, now, but the temperature within the troposphere increases because with global warming, that's what global warming does for you. We've added carbon dioxide. But the temperature of the tropopause has to stay the same. We've just determined that. So the height of the tropopause must increase. So that comes out of a rather simple radiative calculation, independent of any general circulation models. And that's true, of course, if the lapse rate is constant. The lapse rate itself can change. And if the lapse rate changes, we did mention earlier that the lapse rate will change because, in fact, temperature changes and it's most adiabatic. Turns out that makes things move in the same way. It actually makes the tropopause even higher. So skipping a couple of slides. And I will skip that too. We have a simple argument that the tropopause height increases. What happens when we look at all of the models in the IPCC scenario? And here they all are. This is actually the height of the tropopause, but it's actually in pressure. So it goes to a lower pressure. But every single model in the IPCC archive predicts that the tropopause height increases with global warming. So if all of the models do it, and we have a simple model-independent argument which says that that should happen, I would call that a robust result. Well, these are, in a sense, all transient integrations, because they're just running for the next 100 years or so. But in fact, it won't take very long to adjust, a couple of years or something at the most, to make that adjustment. So the tropopause height does increase, it turns out. These dots are all different solutions from different models. Different models have different climate sensitivities. Turns out there's a correlation, and that the more sensitive the model is, the more the tropopause height will increase. Now let's talk about the general circulation, which was the topic of my talk, with 2 minutes left. But let's not worry too much about that. This is the overturning circulation of the atmosphere. This is, just look at the top graph, if you will, it may be more familiar. This is the Hadley cell in the winter hemisphere. It goes up near the equator, it comes down near in the subtropics, where we are now, more or less. So we're about here, air is descending, that's why we get nice weather in Southern California. There are theories for that. The simplest theories go back to a paper by Schneider and Linzen, Ed Schneider, then Held and Howe, which is axisymmetric. They say that, well, as take a ring of air here, move it polewards, it's moving more towards the axis of rotation, therefore it's actually conserves its angular momentum, it's going to spin faster. So zonal velocity will increase. Here it is up here. So zonal velocity will become very high. There's a return flow here with a low zonal velocity, so there's a large shear. There's a large shear, there's a large temperature gradient. So this air is getting colder and colder as it moves polewards. In order to satisfy the thermodynamics, which we haven't talked about, but it's still got to satisfy the thermodynamic equation, it's getting colder and colder, it essentially has to sink, because it gets so cold, it has to sink to satisfy the thermodynamics, and that's the termination of the Hadley cell. A more quantitative theory of that then tells us that the latitude of the Hadley cell varies according to the half power of the height of the tropopause. I won't go into the theory of that. Again, this is axisymmetric. But it says that if the tropopause then increases in height, the Hadley cell will get wider. But finally getting some eddies into here, topic of this conference. Eddies make an enormous difference to the strength of the Hadley cell. This is the Hadley cell in an axisymmetric model, and it's weak and broad. If we actually allow eddies to form, these are baroclinic eddies, baroclinic turbulence, the Hadley cell is much stronger, but it's also narrower. The reason, arguably the reason that it's narrower, is because the Hadley cell, that shear, becomes baroclinically unstable. So this is the velocity against latitude. This is the velocity of the Hadley cell in an axisymmetric model, increasing rapidly with latitude. But then this is the wind at which it would become baroclinically unstable. So at some latitude, around about 30 degrees, it becomes baroclinically unstable. And hence, according to this argument, the Hadley cell terminates. And then you get a slightly more complex dependence of the Hadley cell latitude on the height of the tropopause. But it also suggests that the Hadley cell will expand if the tropopause height increases. Is this the right theory? Maybe. And what do the models predict? I don't know how well you can see these curves, but each of these is a model submitted to the IPCC archive. And this is the trend in the Hadley cell. In other words, how much wider the Hadley cell gets in all of these models. And over the next 70 or so years, the Hadley cell is actually predicted to get wider. But there's a lot of scatter in the models. You can see this model hardly predicts it to get wider at all. This model predicts it to get wider by almost 2 degrees. So the actual intermodel scatter of the prediction of how much wider the Hadley cell will get is actually as large as the prediction itself. So it's getting to be a little bit less robust. Okay, so northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, each point is a model prediction. Typically, the models are predicting about a 1 degree expansion, but 1 degree plus or minus 1 degree. So not so. In middle latitudes, it's an even harder problem, because now, perhaps it's an even harder problem, because really, now the surface westerlies are really determined by the momentum flux of the eddies. So it really becomes much more of a turbulent problem. So it really is, in a sense, a wave mean flow problem. This is the mean flow. This is the momentum flux divergence integrated over the height of the atmosphere. So the surface winds are just determined by... Now, the surface winds have this typical pattern. Westerlies in mid latitudes, here and here. Easterlies in low latitudes. A very typical problem, very typical pattern. What happens to those with global warming, according to the models, is that the latitude of the westerlies also shifts. But there's really a lot of scatter here. I mean, this model is predicting that the latitude of the westerlies will shift by 4 degrees, this one by much less. They're all small differences, but they're kind of important. I mean, shifting of climate by 2 degrees is quite a lot. It's about the difference between London and Paris. And we've all heard the expression springtime in Paris. We never hear about spring in London. So if London becomes Paris, you know, it's certainly a difference. You know, there are shifts of a couple of degrees predicted by all of the models. The theory is much less on solid ground as to what is happening here. There are quite a lot of, and furthermore, well, these are all different models. It's a scatter plot of the shift in the southern hemisphere westerlies versus the northern hemisphere westerlies. It's kind of all over the place. So although the models are predicting that the jets generally move polewards, there's very little consistency in how much they predict the westerlies will move polewards, and there's very little consistency in the northern southern hemisphere. Well, it may be. It's possible. That is possible that it is a statistical anomaly. But on the other hand, we'd like to make an estimate on what will happen in the next 70 years. The atmosphere just has one realization. So either way, you'd like to know. I don't know whether it's premature or not, because there is a consistent prediction that there's a poleward shift in all of the westerlies. A small poleward shift is consistent across nearly all of the models. If they may all be wrong in the same way. Yes, it is all over the place, but by and large, there is a pole which, I mean, I'm in part agreeing with you. I'm saying that this is a delicate matter that we need to.
Yes.
Well, perhaps. I'm not sure I agree with that statement. I mean, if everything were to shift a degree polewards in a consistent way, including all of the meanders, then that would be a that would be an important effect. Well, they could be, they could do that, and they certainly do on a day-to-day basis. Whether they do that on the average, I think if you take a single model and run it for 50 years and look at where the jet stream is, and then run it for the next 50 years, it will be in the same position to within much less than the variance of here. Oh yes. No, no. Well, it might. I mean, I think we're partially agreeing. I mean, I'm saying that I'm saying that there is a change in the latitude of the westerlies, but there's a lot of variability, and we would like to understand that better. In fact, we'd like to understand that better. We'd like to understand. Okay, I'm finishing up. Yeah, okay. Okay, it's also the case that the shift of the Hadley cell in the middle latitude westerlies is not well correlated. And you might expect, no matter what, that if the Hadley cell were terminated by the onset of bioclinic instability, that the shift, the expansion of the Hadley cell and the shift in the westerlies would be highly correlated, and in fact it's not. And perhaps this is sort of where my talk was meant to begin. Well, in a sense, was that the edge of the Hadley cell, so this is a sort of a schematic of what the Hadley cell is doing. It's going up here and it's coming down here. And it's certainly eddy influenced. And if you look at the equation of the motion, the edge of the Hadley cell is determined by where, essentially where a lot of the breaking of the waves is, where the divergence of the eddy momentum flux is zero. So we certainly have an eddy-influenced Hadley cell, but nonetheless that can be quite distant from where these, from the genesis of these waves. The genesis of these waves is in middle latitudes in the bioclinic zone, which let's say for the sake of argument is 50 degrees, which generates Rossby waves which propagate equatorwards and break as they enter the subtropics. And it's the breaking which determines the termination of the Hadley cell, not where the zonal jet becomes bioclinically unstable. So this really is a wave mean flow problem, which I think one could actually address with some of the tools like the tools that Brad and Steve have talked about, because it's really not a highly turbulent problem. It's more of a wave mean flow problem. So so I'll end with that. Thank you for trying to listen.
Mm-hmm. 2 minutes for questions. Jeff, regarding the position of the mid-latitude westerlies, can we use paleoclimate data? This suggests, you know, during the depth of the ice age, the Earth is cooler, that the jets were further to the south. But on the other hand, perhaps the ice sheet, the continental ice sheet, is a perturbation that isn't really analogous to what's happening.
I mean, the I would like to use paleo data, but there's a saying that nothing changes faster than paleo data. So one's never quite sure. And I would doubt that, I mean, these changes that we're talking about for global warming are actually rather small and rather delicate. I think what paleo data, if the paleo data were robust and believable, I think we could certainly use it as a check against whether the GCMs, for example, are behaving in a reasonable way. I don't know what the resolution of the paleo data is.
I have a question. No, I have a question. I have the microphone here.
Sasha.
I have a question, which you are speaking of 1 or 2 degree difference. And from what I understood, it may not be the case of the latest computation that was recently published about global warming, but up to recently, the hydro core of the simulation were something like 60 cube. And you need to have a 1 degree resolution to have a lot of points,
yeah.
Much more than you would need to do a 200 or 300 cube simulation, which I don't know if what you are showing us is actually at that resolution.
These are about a 1 degree resolution.
So they do. But so if you have a 1 degree resolution,
yeah.
How confident can you be on a 1 degree shift?
I agree.
I'm being serious. Yes.
That's a good point.
Just a side comment on that, which, okay, we agree. I was wondering.
Also on that point, I mean, the routine calculations are at about one degree or something like that. People also do more specialized calculations at much higher resolution, you know, one-off calculations.
Okay.
Point taken, yes.
So I have a question which is more to understand what's behind the model. Do you have any, perhaps it's too high in the atmosphere so it doesn't have an impact, but do you take into account the coupling to the ocean and to the topography? And can, you know, for example, the Himalayas, since we're speaking of, you know, regional modification, can the Himalayas or some of the Andes block some of the change and kind of create, you know, a non-uniform shift of things?
Yes, to all of the above. The models which people use, these general circulation models, are perhaps the most sophisticated numerical models in existence. I mean, well over 1 million lines of code. So they include, you know, full spherical geometry, land surface, ocean transports. They have an ocean model coupled to the atmosphere. They have sea ice. They're to some degree clones of one another. I mean, there's two problems. They're in part, these are not all independent points. And the other problem, which is in a sense what I'm trying, one of the arguments which I'm trying to make, it goes back to this this very first slide, is to look for independent verification, I guess, is the looking for an underlying physical mechanism. The models have become so complex that it's almost impossible to understand the models. I mean, it's like understanding or trying to understand the real behavior of the real system. So I think we need to have a program of sort of simplification of the models to figure out what is robust and what is not robust.
That seems an excellent place to stop. So,
Owen, thank you.